Hey, Rocketeers and lovers. I'm Karen Tongson, filling in for Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, the weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, Winter. We're already getting hot and heavy up in here. We have journalist and novelist, Margaret Wappler.
Hi there, Karen.
Hey, Margaret. It's so nice to see you pre-show as well as during show.
I know. We pre-gamed at the Prince, one of LA's finest establishments.
Exactly.
It needed to happen.
It needed
I kind
to
of
happen.
Miss pre-show Wappler.
The pre-game.
Yeah.
Exactly. We got pre-show Wappler today. And also this week, we have a very special guest. He is the professor of theater, African-American studies, and American studies at the venerable Yale University. Also, a very dear friend who's enjoying his sabbatical here in Los Angeles.
Woo!
With his crystals and yoga.
Yes.
Our dear friend, Tavia Just Tav and Yongo.
Hey, how's it going? This has been a long-term dream of mine. So,
See, you know, when you come to L.A., Tav, dreams do come true.
It's true.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, coming up on this week's show, we're talking Black Panther. And we're going to try to make it spoiler-free. But, you know, really what we have here in the house is a kind of force of scholastic, scholarly minds and also our regular hot shit minds to talk about this phenomenon. And we're also rounding it out and maybe branching out into other discussions about Black entertainment and popular culture as part of our closing note to February, which is Black History Month.
Right.
So you also know we'll each be sharing our latest gems. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Winter Mitchell, what are you up to this week?
I can't stop thinking about Brendan Fraser's GQ article.
Oh.
I'm not going to like and say that I've been the biggest Brendan Fraser fan. I'm an Encino Man girl. Mm. I'm a School Ties girl.
You like the Cro-Magnon part of Brendan Fraser.
Yes, but then I know that people love him for The Mummy and maybe George of the Jungle. I don't know.
He does radiate goodness.
He radiates goodness.
Yes.
And
I miss that.
And this article really speaks to that. I mean, he is somebody who was literally on the front lines of Hollywood moneymakers for a good solid decade and sort of sprung up out of nowhere. He was in School Ties. I remember being a kid and thinking like he was the breakout star of that movie when all the other ones ended up being the breakout stars later on in their careers. But this article is heartbreaking.
Really?
And yes, Tom Cruise would never do this article. And he should. And it would actually benefit him if he did. He breaks down sort of everything that took him out of the spotlight. It's all debilitating. It's from mental, you know, issues dealing with sort of sexual harassment by the HFPA president at the time, the way down to like physical issues that he was dealing with from doing the mummies. I mean, he was doing his own stunts. Apparently.
And, really?
Yeah. And he like almost broke his back and almost, you know, had issues going all the way drawing up to his cranium. And it created problems for him physically where he couldn't work. And he talks about sort of why, you know, there's a viral moment that went around last year where he was doing an AOL chat, AOL bill chat. And everybody said, he seems so sad and he seems like not happy. And he was like, yeah, because my mom died and I wasn't really happy. And I'm... You know, like being honest about these things, you have to read the article. I don't want to tell anybody to read it. I mean, everything about it. I really want people to read it because I think that working in this business, people don't talk about what actually comes.
The toll that it genuinely takes.
Mm-hmm. Tom Cruise breaks his ankle and it's a worldwide story. And he comes and he gets to be on like a British chat show and be like, I broke my ankle. But Mission Impossible 7 is like amazing. But he's like, I'm actually depressed. And this is really freaking hard.
I think there's something really valuable, too, about men sharing Me Too stories. Because it shows how these power structures are not always played out in the simple gender binary of like man has control over woman. Like it goes in a lot of different ways. It flows in a lot of different ways. And I do feel like men and trans people have Me Too stories. And I feel like they, to a certain extent, have been denied those stories by some people, by some segments of that movement. And I think hearing, and I'm starting to feel like anybody who left Hollywood under mysterious circumstances
yeah.
might have a Me Too story.
Yes.
Like, there's a good slice of them now that have come forward and said, actually, it wasn't just like I decided to change my life or
yeah.
I just fell out of favor or whatever. There's more to it, it
There's
seems
more
like.
To it, and that's what he's basically answering to that. And by the way, this was the most read and trafficked story on GQ.com ever.
Really?
Yes. But I don't feel like anybody would do that in his that was at his level yeah. and stature. I don't feel like
he's comfortable being vulnerable.
He has to be, I feel like, yeah. now.
Well, in the vein of talking about Me Too stories, yeah. I think, Margaret, you have another story to share with yeah. us that's also in print media that's been circulating quite a bit recently.
Yeah, I was really taken with Monica Lewinsky's essay in Vanity Fair about her feelings on the Me Too movement. And, okay, first of all, the article starts with her recounting an experience last Christmas where she's having dinner with her family in a nice Manhattan restaurant. And they're celebrating, and it's a good time. And she sees this man across the room, and she's like, who is that? I know that face.
The man in the hat.
The man in the hat. And it turns out to be, lo and behold, Ken Starr. And they never...
The worst.
The worst. And they never actually really met in person during that whole entire trial. They were obviously quite aware of each other, but never had a head-to-head meeting. And they finally, you know, she gets up and comes up to him, and he asks her a bunch of times, are you okay? Are you doing all right? Yeah.
That's
and
right,
which is like, if you were really so concerned, you wouldn't have spent 14 months yeah. like prosecuting her entire life
bitch.
Or whatever.
Oh,
but at any rate, so she makes this point, which I thought was so brilliant, such grace under pressure, of like introducing him to her entire family. Like, she's like, here's my mother who you tried to depose, and here's my aunt, and here's my father, and here are all these people that, like, you tried to get them to turn against me. Because he did. He tried to get her mother, for instance, to testify against her. So at any rate, like, it's this incredible story of this run-in with Kenneth Starr, but also her feelings about the Me Too movement and all that it's dredged up about her own experience with Bill Clinton. And the thing that I admire so much about this essay is that she really resists the urge, and she could have quite easily have taken it, to define her story as yet another Me Too story. Mm-hmm. She doesn't say at any point, like, I was taken advantage of, I was sexually assaulted. Like, she still maintains some degree of responsibility in the affair, but she does acknowledge that what is consent when it's between an intern and the president.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's so much there about the complexity of her experience and the aftermath of the experience right. is really respected. And at no point does she just decide to take the easy way out at any point. Not that it's an easy way out to say, yes, me too, but like, she could have taken that narrative and gotten all the sort of, I don't know, like the respect and people being like, you were taken advantage of.
Yeah.
And like, she just doesn't take that easy way out.
These experiences, the experiences Monica had, it happened in the White House, it was blown up on the news, it was part of an impeachment trial, but just the structural elements of it are things that so many people experience on the everyday in so many different situations. And I think what it does show us is that, like, you can reflect back on these moments that are consensual, that can be like about intimacy in all these different ways, but that have a residue or lingering aftertaste of an abuse of power.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really it pays heed to the fact that consensual doesn't always mean easy.
Yeah, or okay.
Yeah. You can still have icky feelings.
Yeah,
and it's
still
consensual.
Icky feelings, yeah. Speaking of icky feelings, I want to ask Tov about his All About, which I know is a big new show that has been the source of some controversy.
Yeah, it actually, it's sort of a good segue, since we've been back revisiting like the 90s. This is the beginning of the 90s, right? Which is when I was in high school, there were basically two categories of Gen Xers, right? Like, both interestingly involved Winona Ryder, right? But it was basically Reality Bites versus Heathers, right?
Yes!
You know, and I was
yes!
very, very much on the side of Heathers, right? I was against sincerity. I was against, you know, that really was the film that got me through high school. Although going back and watching it again decades later, as I did, I think by coincidence last year, I was like, oh my God, this is such a problematic film, right?
Yeah.
You know, especially the Christian Slater character who we all kind of idolized, and then realized, oh my God, this guy is like a school shooter and a paranoid, you know, and his father is not much better. Anyways, so this is coming back to Paramount TV as a television series.
Heather is the TV show.
Heather is the TV show. And the source of controversy is that they've reimagined the three Heathers who are the, like, alpha bitches of this school as a
the people that the Heathers in the original would have made fun of
are now the ones on top, right? Yeah. You know, and so it's a black girl, a trans feminine person who would maybe appear as a gender nonconforming, and a girl of size, right? You know, and they in the first 10 minutes like haze this white jock for wearing like a racist t-shirt and like make him take his shirt off, you know. So it's very kind of zeitgeisty, and it's clearly in the wake of the success of Riverdale, which reinvented Archie comics. You know, my boyfriend calls it Tween Peaks.
Shout out to Dan Lark.
Yeah, shout out to Dan Lark for Tween Peaks, right? You know, so but this one, I think people are calling it you know, Heathers for the Trump era, which clearly it is by definition. We're in the Trump era.
About people who've run rampant with their PC politics, right?
Yes.
Supposedly. Yeah.
That is basically the theme of the show, right? That PC has engineered this reversal and the normies, right? Handed off to, you know, Veronica is presented as this icon of like the normal, right? I think it's more complicated than simply, obviously, I don't think it's taking a alt-right perspective, but it clearly is zeroing in on precisely the kinds of issues that came out over the last election.
Yeah. And I do think that, you know, so I did read, I think it may have been a Daily Beast piece, right? One of our friends of Pop Rocket, Ali Picard, on the Facebook page posted this article about the new Heathers.
It's five male writers.
And the headline is, it's a Trumpian LGBT bashing show.
Yeah. Nightmare. Yeah.
And so, but I did watch the pilot, and I have to say, like, for the first half of it, you know, and I read the sort of, I read the comments, our other friend of Pop Rocket, Alonzo Duralde, is like, I know several, like, queer people or men who are involved in writing the show, and they knew that it would be misunderstood. And then, so I watched the first half of it, and I was like, this, like, clickbaity headline seems about right on right now, because essentially, like, the targets of comeuppance and violence are these, like hyper individualized, hyper categorized people. Like the black woman is somebody who is fronting as a black lesbian, but then, you know, I mean, spoiler alert, there's something that compromises that identity.
A dick.
Of course, right.
Perhaps.
Okay.
A little D. Yeah. It might start with the letter D. But then, you know, and then you see, and of course, the master manipulator of the girl who says, basically, and it's all around this kind of concept of, like, college admissions. Like, one of the things, like, that Veronica character, right, is, like, essentially with a college counselor and saying, the college counselor's like, well, what can we say you are so you can get into the college you want to get into, right? And I'm like, fuck, this shit is, like, you know, a little too intense. I know that it's a critique of the kind of hyper-individualization.
Does it want it both ways?
I think it's trying to do it both ways. I don't know what your take, though, Tav, is. So.
Yeah, I think it wants it both ways, but also depending on how you view a show like this. Like, on most days, I'm an accelerationist, right, in the sense that I think, like, the only way out of these contradictions is through them, right? So I'm actually all for culture that intensifies and puts in our face what America actually is.
Yeah.
And so for every person who would look at the three new Heathers and be like, oh my God, these are monsters, right? There's someone like me who's like, oh my God, I wish I could be at the high school where they were running the show. You know, like, so it's sort of, it kind of counts, I think, you know, the critics assume that the only people out there watching are people who are already predisposed to identify with the alt-right. But in fact, there are many so-called social justice warriors, like, who are going to watch this show and react to it and find points of identification, right?
Yeah.
And for them, the way, I don't want to give any spoilers, the fact that it is a kind of TV series takes a kind of premise or a plot that's very, very familiar, you know, and then by definition opens it out to a different set of directions, right? Because it's going to be a series.
Yeah.
You know, there's a huge plot twist in which it deviates from the film in that first episode. So we don't really actually know if this is going to be
which
an alt-right wet dream or actually a kind of, you know, hand-to-hand combat with those ideas, right? And that's what I think is interesting, is that there are these very, very non-traditional, you know, it's actually kind of segued to Black Panther in a way, in which the kind of most interesting and debated character in popular media is the villain of Black Panther,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And everyone's like, well, he's the villain. Well, I mean, actually, if you're a comic book reader and fan, right, the villains are often where you, like, find your, you know.
Yeah.
The point more of the story.
Yeah.
But I do think that that is where the pilot leaves us. And that's so, as of our taping currently, that's all we've had available to us is this particular pilot. I know it's not super accessible for everyone, but I do think that people will watch it. And even before Tav, like, would sort of honed in on this is like wanting to talk about it this week, our Rocketeers were already on it. So you know that there are people who are getting ready to watch
it.
That's
true. Mm-hmm. And I love the Rocketeers and I trust them.
All right. So my all about this week, the Rocketeers also mentioned, even before they knew that I would be talking about it on the show tonight, and it is yet another new Netflix series. And this is from the foodie branch of the Netflix platform, and it's called Ugly Delicious, and it's the new series with David Chang and food writer Peter Meehan. They co-founded Lucky Peach together. They became BFFs.
Yeah.
They became BFFs because Peter Meehan was really like the guy who put Momofuku on the map by writing the first New York Times review of that restaurant, and basically like Momofuku blew up after that. Mm-hmm. And so like they've been lifelong friends. What some people have noted is that maybe this show was meant to be like the Lucky Peach TV show, but had to be renamed when the magazine folded under mysterious circumstances because it wasn't making enough money, because print culture doesn't. Right. So
sad.
So the show, I will say, like, I dug into it, and I'll say that it's a really fascinating watch, and it's very intriguing. I'm going to start with my cons, though. I'm going to start with my cons because, you know, this was my experience of watching it. So it takes about 70 minutes to hear a single female talking about food.
That's not cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
So to hear a single woman even talk about food or be incorporated into the like kind of food scene. And this is very typical of most food shows. It's very bro-centric. Obviously, Master of None skewered that. And, you know, we get this in, like, the kind of Bourdain universe as well.
Yeah.
But this was, you know, the first episode is on pizza. So, like, the premise of each episode is it takes a kind of ubiquitous food and really goes to different points around the world to think about its formation, its spread, its idealized and platonic forms. So, the first episode's on pizza. There's an episode on tacos. Obviously, it's like they bounce between all parts of the world, from Tokyo to Los Angeles to Copenhagen to wherever. And so you get that travelogue aspect of it. But yeah, it takes that long to get a single woman to talk about things. And it was in the tacos episode where finally, like, oh, let's talk to a Latinx woman who's based in Copenhagen. To talk about this, and this was Rocío Sánchez of Hija de Sánchez. Another con is that you have to have tolerance for David Chang.
Oh.
Yeah, so Dave Chang, like, some people really worship him and adore him because he's like another one of these kind of tough talking,
like Eddie Huang. Like Eddie Huang,
he's the more scholarly version of Eddie Huang. He's a much more refined guy. Refined is the improper word, but it's just sort of like he's very thoughtful.
Okay.
So he's kind of in a spectrum between Bourdain, who writes in these and narrates in these purple prosy ways, and a dude like Eddie Huang, who's all about just like grabbing his balls and scratching them
right.
and touching the food. So, but
ouch!
I will say,
damn, I won't be having.
I will say what the show
I feel
does.
Like washing my hands.
Yeah,
right now.
I don't want to have a Korean taco, Kobe beef, anything anymore.
What the show does successfully is it really kind of captures these different food ways, the different transmissions of food cultures that transform something like a pizza or a taco. The best episode, and not just because of my personal predilections, I think is the fried chicken episode is like a really solid one. And that's, you know, and it moves around the world in so many different ways. But partly also because that's when they consult people who aren't just chefs or people who like to eat or celebrities. Aziz Ansari shows up in a couple episodes.
Oh boy.
But the fried chicken episode has people like food historian Lawless Eric Ellie, Dolly Ingram, the owner of Nashville's hot chicken place Bolton's, and the scholar Psyche Williams Forson, an amazing food scholar who writes about food, race, blackness, like the history of like chicken. And so you get like a lot of deep historical dives. And so I think it can be really gratifying in that way. The title is a reference to David Chang says, Ugly Delicious is what he thinks of as home cooking. So it's food that is like nurturing and delicious and soulful, but that it's not tweezered.
It's kind
and
of
it's
slop
not like,
on
yeah,
the plate.
It's kind of a little bit sloppy. So that's sort of where it comes from. One last thing, and I do want to shout this out to a member of the Pop Rocket Facebook group. Beckett Graham observed that the show owes its structure to podcasting. And I do think that there's, maybe that's part of the thing that like makes me really kind of into the way the show is unfolding, at least stylistically and experimentally, is that there is a kind of podcasty aspect to it, a series of conversations, and there isn't so far like necessarily an authoritative voice that holds forth. So you're listening to Pop Rocket, and we'll be right back to talk Black Panther, etc.
Woo!
Wakanda forever. After this.
Are you sad and confused about world politics? Worried about the upcoming inevitable nuclear war? Or maybe a rat is living in your house? There's a rat living in my house. How do you get rid of a rat from a house? Why not immerse yourself in a completely fictional, imagined podcast for the beef and dairy industries? It works for me. The Beef and Dairy Network podcast is the number one podcast for those involved, or just interested, in the production of beef animals and dairy herds. Don't worry, it's funnier than it sounds. Find us at beefanddairynetwork.com or maximumfun.org or wherever you get your podcast from. Oh, God, there's the rat. Oh, God.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Karen Tongson. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Tav Nyong'o.
So
say with a little bit more excitement. I know it's not the Black Panther also, red carpet. God,
say
I know it's just a box in East LA, but Jesus.
Say and. How come the last person doesn't say and yet. Anymore?
Hey, look, this is Tom's first time in the hot box.
Okay.
So we got
speaking of hazing, let's just haze
seriously.
The fuck out of Tom.
Do they do this at Yale? Can I get into the Yale Comedy Club now?
Maybe it is.
Or, the Whiff and Poofs. The Whiff and Poofs just admitted their first female member, so the answer is probably
wow.
yes.
Wow. Interesting.
I want to know what she sings.
Member.
Is it like exactly. tenor? Okay. So this week we're talking about Black Panther, its status in the kind of pantheon of Black culture, Black entertainment, Black popular culture. And before we really get rolling in this conversation, I want to ask each of our panelists, what was your experience watching it? Where did you watch it? What was the scene? Paint a picture for me. Show me a picture. Sicily, 1910. What was it like to visit Wakanda? Where were you when you went to Wakanda?
I went to the ArcLight opening night.
Okay. Did you
the
buy your tickets in advance?
Respectable opening night. Like, okay. I went Friday. Okay. Not through no Thursday at midnight shit.
Okay.
I went dressed as Black Twitter. I wore full Nike head to toe with a Twitter cap. And then I also had big hoop earrings, so I was basically Black Twitter. I walked in knowing what I expected, and I got what I expected, and I was sheer happiness from the beginning to the end. And it was also like a disruptive for me because it had reminded me, I started thinking about immediately all the people who had tried to accomplish this very thing, building a universe which is predominantly African American, and hoping that it
or
would make
African and American.
African yeah. and American, that too, touche. but in hoping for a universe built that would reap even more dividends. Mm-hmm. And I literally sat there and simultaneously enjoyed the shit out of this movie. Save for like one thing, but that's not a big deal because it happens in every movie, Marvel movie. But also feeling like every sort of scene that resonated with me, saying thank you, Richard Pryor, thank you, Eddie Murphy, thank you, Red Fox, thank mm-hmm. you, Nat King Cole, thank you, you know, every single Bill, even Bill Cosby. thank you. Sorry. But thank you for like representing us in a way that diversifies what people expect from us so that we can get to this point today. Because as soon as I saw that movie and walked out, I was like, shit, this movie is going to make a shit ton of money. Mm-hmm. And I walked out very proud. I didn't actually have my Black Panther cry, as we've called it on Black Twitter. It wasn't immediate. For a lot of African-American men that I'm very close to, it was like they cried at the end of the movie, and some of my women friends, my African-American women friends, but it took me like a week to cry.
Mm-hmm. My experience was very different insofar as I saw it at the Vista Theater, which is in Los Feliz, which is a beautiful, like, kind of classic old Hollywood theater, but it is very populated with hipsters, sure. Right? So I went to like the first Sunday matinee of its opening weekend, and I went with my beloved friends, many of whom are hipsters and academics or white, And of course, you know, it was a packed house. I saw more Black people at the Vista than I've seen in a long time.
Yeah.
But also beyond that, like, I would say that the kind of feeling at the end of the film, or like the response at the end of the film, was sort of interesting to me, because there was clapping in a very polite, like, kind of, I just saw a great piece of theater way.
Yeah.
Masterpiece Marvel. Absolutely. I know that some people must have had a sense of euphoria after watching it. There were other people, but it was an interesting response to sort of register on this weekend where actually it was chaotic. People were in line like around the block and buying tickets and all this stuff. It was kind of crazy. Golf clapping.
After everybody goes around, I have an answer to that. Yeah.
Golf clapping to that. So that was my experience of watching it. Margaret Wobbler, did you bring Silas to see it?
Yo, interesting.
I did not. I would not do that to myself. I saw it too at the Vista, and I saw it today.
Okay.
So basically
Wobbler! You've been keeping that close to the chest.
That I saw it today?
Yeah.
I said it when we were having drinks.
Okay. Yeah. I was late to that.
So basically I parked my car, I ran into the theater. I don't even know who was in the theater because I came in right at like 1:31, like 1 minute late to the screening, sat down next to my husband, and I was like, I'm ready to see this. And you know, when we talked about Wonder Woman, we talked about how Themyscira, the place that it was set in, was like so wondrous right off the bat, you know, just these like women walking around on their horses and polishing their swords and all that kind of thing. And I had this same kind of instantaneous feeling about Wakanda, where I was like, ooh, this magical place that I want to be spending time in. And it felt really indulgent and lovely to escape my regular life and at 1:30 in the afternoon plug into this movie. And you know, the audience, I think, yeah, Vista, it wasn't exactly the most exciting audience to see the movie with. Like, everyone was like, oh, very good, very good.
It's like, I'm not at the cafe today. I might just get to see Black Panther.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I might pitch Marvel something soon, so I want to see it.
I want to see it.
Yeah. But, you know, I think for me, like, at first the movie, it was tantalizing from the very start, but it packed in a lot of story, and it packed in so much story right away that I was a little scrambled, and I haven't read the comic books. I don't know the whole...
And you probably didn't see Civil War.
I didn't.
Okay.
No. So I really was coming into it pretty blind, and like a lot of story was coming at me, and I think the first scene that I felt like I really locked into the movie was the South Korea scene.
Yeah.
Where I've been, Busan, South Korea.
Yes.
I've been there.
And it was so like sexy and thrilling. And yeah. I felt like every component.
You get the Weeknd singing in the background.
Yes! And the like and the neon lights and the tiny streets and the way that the cars are like thumping and thundering down those tiny little roads.
Ooh, and soundtrack against
it. Yes, exactly. Oh. The soundtrack was like everything just came together. And then I was like, I'm in it. Yeah. I'm here for this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it took me a little bit to charm me. I mean, I was like I was on its side from the get-go, but at the same time, I was like, Marvel, I don't know. Are you going to mess this up?
You had the Monday matinee skepticism.
Yeah.
Coming into it.
Exactly. A little Monday jadedness. Yeah.
I mean, because there was so much eventness around.
Yes.
It's release, and even a Rocketeer started a thread where people were posting photos of them going to the premiere. Special guest star Tava Nyong'o, tell us how you first saw this film. And keep in mind, I just said his last name, Nyong'o.
Nobody brought a sweet potato pie and a whole full plate into your your viewing, I assume.
Okay. Well, actually, there was ugly, delicious food involved with my weekend. Let me take it back and say that I went to the premiere, and it was royal attire requested.
And not just any premiere at, like, you know, like midnight on Thursday night before the show.
Spell the goods here, Tom.
Give us a little, like, background here.
I'm setting it up. Okay, so here's the background. Okay, so I went to the Hollywood premiere as the guest of my cousin who was in the movie. And special about it is that both my brothers came.
Okay.
And I grew up in, not Wakanda, in Kenya, when I wasn't in the Midwest. And back in the 80s, me and my brother, older brother, we had a subscription to Marvel Comics in Nairobi, Kenya. So we got, like, Power Man and Iron Fist and the X-Men mailed to us. So we've been waiting for this premiere since the 1980s, basically, right? You know, oddly enough, the Black Panther, you know, full disclosure, is not my favorite Black superhero in the Marvel Universe. Storm.
Whoa.
No, that's obviously Storm.
Okay, obviously.
No, I've been holding out for the Storm movie, right?
And I'm unapologetic. It's coming now more than ever.
Exactly. And that's one of the great things about this movie, right, is that it has really been, you know, there's this debate, is it revolution? You know, I think, is it revolutionary? We can get into that. I think it's definitely been, like, a revelation, right? I think everyone has woken up. It's like, you can go around the world and you can expect people to have seen this movie or be planning to see it. Like, that's kind of amazing. Not just other Black people, like, everybody has to see this movie. That's kind of, I think, that, like, reverential clap at the end is like, oh my God, there's this universe. There's Wakanda realized in this way that has never been pictured in any prior Marvel Universe film, right? Wakanda's appeared, but never in this way, never in this, like, loving detail, right? And the rich diversity of the African continent and the African diaspora, right?
Yeah.
So royal attire requested.
Attire. So how did you interpret royal attire?
So my brother brought Maasai beads and a fly whisk from Kenya. And, like, this is obviously a confabulation, right? You know, we're not Maasai. Like, it's a little bit of an invented, well, it's Wakanda. So there's this excuse to just combine all your different Black signifiers.
Mm-hmm.
So royal attire, that was the genius. Royal attire meant whatever fly outfit you wanted to wear, you know? And, like, the red carpet was purple. So it really was, like, a Black premiere, right? Mm-hmm. And after party, you see Snoop Dogg, all that kind of stuff. It was really kind of amazing to
lean away.
You know, like, anyways, my brother was to the moon. I was to the moon. My other brother was there too. Like, it was just a really, you know, my actually extended family, right? You know, whenever you have
the Nyong'os were in the house.
Whenever you have an African in a movie, there will be a large entourage of Africans in attendance,
order
right?
Order more town cars. Sorry.
You know, order more. Exactly, right. And the ugly, delicious thing, which I'll mention just since we were talking about it earlier, is that I decided the day before just to have, like, a private event for my family and cook them a Kenyan meal.
Oh, wonderful.
And that was, like, a really nice time to sort of just, like, keep it real a little, you know, think about, like, you know.
So what was that ugly, delicious Kenyan meal that you made at home?
Ugali and sukumawiki.
And what is that?
Ugali is basically cornmeal mush. I don't know. It doesn't sound as nice when you say it that way, right?
No, it does.
Like,
I love cornmeal mush.
It's just like
mush.
Home cooking, right? You know, it's like stick to your ribs. Sukumawiki is kale, you know?
I feel like you shared a recipe for this a long time ago on Facebook, like how to make it in the slow cooker. Oh my God.
Yeah.
I've had it.
Ugali, sukumawiki, nyoyo, which is mason beans, and fish, which is a sort of fish of...
Amazing.
Nigerians have made this. I've had this from my Nigerians.
They call it fufu, I think,
They call it fufu! Yeah. That's what it is.
I mean, as we're detouring into kind of discussions of Africa and Africanness, I mean, we talk about, like, the significance of Black Panther in the context and the pantheon of, like, Black U.S. entertainment. But let's step back a little bit and think about, you know, its Africanism. And it's Afrocentrism, it's Afrofuturism. What, you know, how do we respond to this kind of, like, centering or recentering, rather, of this, you know, futuristic, vibrant, not post-colonial, but never colonial Wakanda that's depicted for us in Black Panther?
You know, what I think is so interesting is that people have been using the word centering a lot. And I feel like it's not even centering, it's just totalism. It's like that is the complete focus is Africa and blackness. And there's not even really a whiteness to bounce off of. I mean, it's there.
It's incidental whiteness.
Yeah.
And it's often, it's not even just incidental, but it's also like really annoying and petty forms of whiteness that can be kind of discarded and incorporated as you wish.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, and like really the white characters who are there move the plot along, but they're not super developed, and they're token almost as sort of a wink wink joke thing.
Yeah.
While still being like full, like I was impressed by the fact that they could be both token and fleshed out. Like that was actually admirable. But I thought what was so interesting about it too is that it's really not, I mean, we've been talking a little bit about, you know, is it African American? Is it African? Like, what exactly is it? And it felt so deeply African to me, and that the African American part was a sort of side path of it, and comes through in the Michael B. Jordan character, but isn't the central conceit of the movie. Go ahead.
This is my cue to do the thing. Put my scholar hat on and tell a little bit about the history of the Black Panther character, right? Because the Black Panther character, it's funny you say this is such an Afrocentric character. The Black Panther was totally invented in New York City by like two white dudes, right? Jack Kirby and Stan Lee. And what's fascinating about that story is that that happened in July of 1966, right? Everyone is confused about like the relationship between the Black Panther Party, right? For self-defense, that was the Black, actually the Revolutionary Socialist, you know, party founded by Bobby Seale and Huey Newton in Oakland, California, in October of 1966, right? But everyone swears up and down that this is some very weird cosmic coincidence, right? Where like these Marvel comic book invent this African hero right at the same moment that the Black Panther icon is being adopted by Black self-determination in California, right? And what I love about the film is that Killmonger is the sort of hinge between these two worlds, and
Killmonger being the Michael B. Jordan.
Michael B. Jordan character, right? He is of Wakandan descent, born in Oakland, right? The film also more or less opens, I don't know if it's exactly the first scene, but there's a very important early scene that's set in Oakland, and it closes in Oakland, right?
Yeah.
And so there's this way in which the film highlights the degree to which this Africa is the Africa of the diasporic imagination, right?
Yeah.
And what's wonderful about that is that they also had the, you know, audacity or whatever, or like the creative control to bring in African voices, right? Mm-hmm. So we hear Baba Maal, the Senegalese singer on that soundtrack, and we hear Kendrick Lamar, and we hear The Weeknd, right, who is like Afro-Canadian of Ethiopian descent, right? So it's really, I think that the soundtrack of this film is going to be as significant for Black culture as the film, right? Because it's going to insinuate itself into daily life in a way that, you know, a big, you know, film, you see it once, right? But like,
Yeah, but I would Margaret, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, do you feel like Wakanda like poses this question of like what would have happened to any given African country that was colonialized if it hadn't been colonialized? Like, is this the thing? Is this the utopian ideal, in a sense, of what could have been in Africa?
Or like the kind of Afrofuturist idealism of, which is kind of where I suppose Afrofuturism resides, is to think not of being colonized, but of, you know, going into these outer realms, outer space, in other zones.
I have a weird answer to this. I think this is like a very personal one, but my answer would be kind of no, in a weird way, right? That like what the Africans are responding to, insofar as I've kind of seen people talking about it on the internet, is not that it's Africa of the future or of the distant past. It's actually of Africa today. Mm. Like the things that they're responding to is the beauty, dignity, you know, like social issues, right? Like it's not as if Africa is a perfect place, right? But there's an overlay of vibranium, which is magic metal, and like these superpowered kings and queens, and but the thing that's so revelatory, right, is that Africans can go into the theater and watch an American or Hollywood made movie
and not feel insulted and dehumanized.
Yes.
Right? That's a sad thing, right? Is that it's actually not about Africa in the future. It's just like, oh, actually, we also have, you know, like, fucked up kings. And, like,
just like valuable narratives.
You know, valuable narratives.
Yeah.
You know,
and the kind of internecine tribe war,
exactly,
tribal wars.
Exactly. You know, we have, you know, brilliant kid sisters who are like technological geniuses,
oh my God,
right?
I
like,
love that
all
character.
That, all that stuff is like actually very everyday. And I think that's what we were speaking about when Winter was speaking about like black joy. That's the joy, right?
Yeah.
Is that like we actually have a lot of joy in our lives,
yeah.
right? We just don't always see that represented right. in Hollywood films, mm-hmm. which really depend upon a, you know, the problem drama,
yeah.
right? You know?
There have been several think pieces, probably most prominently the piece In the Root by Carolyn Hines and Clarkeisha Kent about...
Clarkeisha!
Hello, Clarkeisha. about the double consciousness of Black Panther. And double consciousness for those of you who haven't spent much time reading W.E.B. Du Bois.
Ooh,
or
I
like
love
that
man.
Living in a kind of, you know, in this kind of different... scholarly worlds. Double consciousness is, in Du Bois' terms, very simply, what happens when you have to occupy a consciousness that is of African heritage or descent, also like kind of laden with the history and legacies of slavery, and a Euro-American context or upbringing or broader culture that like frames your entire world, and that you often find yourself split. And you know, dealing with these hybrid sensibilities or identities. And so that's like kind of like, you know, double consciousness 101. But I think that when we think through what double consciousness might mean in Black Panther, we get, at least particularly in that Root piece that I was just talking about, a range of different ways that people are working through, you know, not just the Killmonger, T'Challa dichotomy, but also what you have with M'Baku. And, you know, like that version of wanting to kind of separate from this futurist impulse or that kind of thing. So, I mean, I just like put that out there. And like I'm thinking through the double consciousness of Wakanda, of Black Panther, and also of even some of the other forms of multiple consciousnesses and the forms of space that are really treated in the film. There's a reason that the only place they go outside of Africa is Asia.
Interesting.
In Oakland,
right? Yeah, but like Asia and Oakland.
Yeah,
right? and basically Oakland could be Afro-Asia.
Yeah,
but it's like Busan, you know, or like these sites of tech, the kind of the shared technologies and technicities of these different worlds. I don't know. There's a lot to say about that. I'll throw that in as an aside, but I'll just
it makes me think of Du Bois's famous novel Dark Princess, which is all about this imagined. World revolution led by an African American and a South Asian princess.
Yeah,
right? You know, so like this is a very powerful
and Afrofuturism. So many images and so many of the aesthetics and tropes of that also like a combo of like a kind of Orientalism, outer space, and blackness.
Yeah.
Right.
So can I jump on that?
Cause sure,
I
have sure.
Two quick thoughts. One, you know, it was Karen is alluding to. I, in my own work, talk about or try to think about fabulation rather than futurism, and Black Panther is a good example of why, right? Because it's a virtual space, right? Part of the thing, you know, I mean, Mark was saying earlier, it's like a very African film. It is both a very African film and an American film, right? That's the double consciousness, right? It's this virtual space onto which we project both our futures, but also our sense of our past and our world, right? Our world map, right? And that the African world certainly incorporates a very powerful, I mean, certainly on East Africa, but really throughout the continent, a really powerful, you know, it's called the Indian Ocean, right? You know,
like,
that's the ocean I know, right? You know, and that's the horizon that that I kind of think about. It makes all the sense in the world. I have any number of extended cousins who went to college or got training in Indonesia, in India, in and beyond, right? So that very much is... it makes a lot of sense to go to Korea, right? You know, in some ways. And the other thing is that with double consciousness, which was, you know, kind of coined at sort of like the turn of the century, at the so-called nadir of Black life in America, when you know, the NAACP was calling national attention to like daily and weekly lynchings. You know, there's another kind of
relevant historical marker, and that is the era of decolonization,
yes.
right, and Black power, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so after I saw the film, I, you know, had this really fascinating talk with my uncle, right, who is African, right, you know, and but was
and
living
from
in the
what,
U.S.
From Kenya.
From Kenya, yeah. Okay. My family is Kenyan. And he was living in Chicago and studying during the 60s. So there was a decade in which my uncle and my father were living in a Black city in the center of America. And you know, my own origin stories that my parents met at a Miriam Makeba concert, right? Uh-huh. You know, but that moment in which, let's say, the historical African diaspora founded in the kind of Middle Passage, right, encounters the contemporary African diaspora of students and migrants, and now the children of students and migrants who began to travel, especially after like 45 and after 60s, right? There was the Kennedy airlift, right? This is another thing that very powerfully connects with the Asian American experience, actually, yeah. right? Which is all about, like, mm-hmm. are you Asian or are you Asian American, right?
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah.
clearly, like, the answer is both, right? So it's double consciousness, but also a kind of, and you see it very specifically in the film, which I think was quite beautifully done in the rendering of these costumes, which again are kind of fabulations of very real and yeah. invented African motifs, but also the casting, right, where you have actors from across the diaspora, right?
Yeah.
Playing
Afro-British.
Afro-British, African-American, playing American. Yeah.
African.
You know, American,
yeah.
you know, and yeah. they use actual African languages.
Yeah.
You know, so one person who had the kind of, you know, Black Joy Tear moment is like hearing, you know, a Nigerian language in the opening moments of the movie, right? You know,
yeah.
And of course, Sotho is spoken, Xhosa accent, right? Is spoken throughout the film.
Yeah.
And again, it's a fictional language, Wakandan, right? But it actually right. has a real reference, right?
Right, right.
And there is, I will also say, just a shout out to the Filipinos.
And Lupita speaks Korean at some point.
Oh, yeah, Lupita does
yeah.
speak Korean.
Yeah.
yeah. You have to tell us how she got to learning how to do that.
She's an actor.
She is an actress.
Actor. Acting.
Yes. There is actually one of apparently the tribal costumes of Black Panther that was modeled on an indigenous Filipino tribe.
Interesting.
Well, we should say that it's Ruth Carter that did the costumes.
You know, we're always together.
Yes, I know that.
Yeah, Ruth Carter.
Ruth Carter did the costumes, and she did all those Spike Lee movies.
She killed it.
Yeah, she killed it, and she has a very, like, special history with Black cinema, and I thought that was brilliant that he brought
she
him.
Made those
Brian
people,
Coogler brought her in.
She made them look so... They look
like the
clean.
Women warriors in particular, I thought she just killed it on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, no, just jump in. Can I offer another yeah. angle?
Offer on the, it all.
Yeah.
Just on the double consciousness tip, right? So, like, there are two Black Panthers, right? The other, you know, there's the Black Panther of the comic books, and there's the Black Panther of the political party. I keep mentioning this, right?
Yes,
because
yeah.
you know, another precedent to, you know, what one of the things that was said in the wake of the film is that the only character in the film with the politics of the Black Panther Party are, you know, he's the villain.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's some truth to that, right? Apropos of nothing really to say except a shout out to this film is that in 1995, Mario Van Peebles directed Panther,
yeah.
which is actually a film,
that.
Right? And you know who's in both of these two films? Angela Bassett.
Oh,
Angela
right.
Bassett.
So she's
is,
the connective tissue.
She's the connecting tissue. She plays Dr. Betty Shabazz, Malcolm X's widow, in Panther, wow. right? Courtney B. Vance plays Bobby Seale. Marcus Chong plays Huey Newton. So this is like a weird out-of-the-box thing to throw out there. Like, T'Challa, who is a kind of stoic character, right? He doesn't react much. It's not as entertaining visually on the screen. But he's not a pacifist, actually. He is
yeah.
a warrior king. And the better analog is not MLK. It's actually someone like Kwame Nkrumah.
Mm-hmm.
It is Leopold Sedar Senghor, right? Mm-hmm. Some other person of that generation mm-hmm. who went back to lead their nation,
mm-hmm.
right?
Like
so
after colonialism dissipated. And
exactly,
just,
who
like,
fought
took over.
To overthrow Aimé Césaire, you know,
yeah.
like that generation. And there's a real, actually, to me, this is like the contemporary debate that's really super interesting and difficult in the experience of kind of Black nationalism is that a lot of the Black nationalists of the 50s and 60s got their Black nations.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And we are dealing
Absolutely.
With, you know, Nigeria, Kenya, Jamaica, Haiti, you know, and it hasn't necessarily solved the problems that we thought having a black president would, right? Now, right. America went through that just recently, right? So yeah, we discovered right. that, like, having a black president is not revolutionary, right?
Right.
Yeah. But there's something very freeing in realizing that the challenges facing black people in the diaspora and on the continent aren't solved by who's, like, head of state.
Sure.
Right?
Absolutely. Sure.
And that's an experience yes. that, so that's, yeah. you know, where, you know, when T'Challa is, he's not an MLK figure, actually. He really is this person who's experiencing the kind of, the limited degree to which sovereignty in a single
yes,
nation
yeah.
can solve the issues of black people. And I think that's a very relevant problem for contemporary viewers
sounds
to grapple
like
with.
Sounds like Obama.
Sounds like Obama.
Sorry.
Smells like
smells
Obama.
Like
smells like Obama.
If it walks, it talks like Obama.
So, yeah.
We're about to wrap up. I will ask you. Which
shit, we are?
Yes, we're about to wrap up. I know. We've been
fast.
Having
we
such
do three
we've been getting really
hours.
Deep.
Honestly, we should.
We should.
This movie's about to make $1 billion. Are you yeah. crazy?
Yeah, for the $1 billion that Black Panther's about
to make. We're going to have to do a coda on this, clearly.
Yeah, we're going to have to do.
Turning in his grave.
We're going to have to do a coda on this. But as a superfluous and fluffy question,
yeah.
which Wakandan would you take home?
Wow, this is not appropriate.
Is it not appropriate?
Well, I mean, isn't the answer Michael B. Jordan? I mean, that man yeah, has swagger for fucking days.
Look, I had an audible, visceral, primal response to his appearance on screen. And
I mean,
let's
that's
just say
be a fucking star.
I'm I like, did not have sex this weekend.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Mm, what do you mean?
Curious.
I'm saying that. I had an audible, visceral, primal response to Eric Killmonger.
We might
and
have to cut this segment out
no,
of the
show. No,
you
don't cut that segment
it's like
out.
The okay. private,
I'm
you pay extra.
Pandora's
if you
box
pay extra
here.
For this, you get this segment.
You, exactly, it's, you pay
it's
extra.
It's true. This is like, this
should
is the start of the
Max
Fund. This should be Patreon or like the Max Fund fundraiser.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I want to answer the question. I want to answer the question. It's a, you know, it would be a tie between M'Baku, head of the Jabari clan,
yes.
played
yes.
by Winston Duke.
Yes.
And, surprise, Wakabi.
Interesting.
I was waiting for Daniel
Kaluuya. I can totally see what? You in a Wakabi. Wakabi's more.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
More
yeah.
my speed.
Yeah. More, yeah.
Well, he had the biggest arc, in a sense, in the movie, where, like, he started out being like, okay, I'm on the king's side.
Yeah,
like, I will stay loyal.
Y'all
and then
bullshit.
He's, yeah, he's
yeah.
like, why are we going to catch
happens.
The claw?
Yeah.
Why are we going to catch the claw? Why are we sitting on this?
I can't say Lupita in front of Tom. What
yes,
if he says
can.
Something to Lupita? Please invite Lupita over to dinner at our house soon.
I knew it.
Lupita, man.
But Denai is awesome.
Yeah.
Lupita! Actually, bring them both for me and my partner to like chat with. And Margaret, you're resting with the answer, Michael B. Jordan's Killmonger.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, that's what I remember. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
Winston Duke, we already talked about this on
Who Shot Ya?
Who Shot Ya? Modeled his entire character off of Frasier. Wow. That made
That's
me more attracted to him.
Like, who's the Niles then?
I don't know who the Niles is, but the fact that he, like, modeled his response, especially that sort of, like, funny, like, are y'all done yet? Like, that was, I was like, why do that this feel
oh,
familiar?
Wow.
Yeah, he was
and
adorable.
I was like, Frasier.
He was, like, kind
now
of the only.
Makes so much more sense.
See? That's what I
said. He's the favorite bear.
Yeah, he was
the,
like the yeah. true comedic relief, yeah. though, too. Like,
yes.
I feel like the movie could have screwed up a, like 5% more, like, comedy.
Okay. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, a little bit.
A little like, self-serious.
And on the note of tossed salad and scrambled eggs, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back
Yay!
After this.
In a world dominated by dude bro movie podcasts. A world where Casey Affleck has an Oscar and Angela Bassett does not. Only one podcast is brave enough to call bullshit. Who Shot Ya? With Ricky Carmona.
A lot of people don't know Porgs, Puerto Rican.
Alonzo Duralde.
I would eat oak jaw.
April Wolf.
I want to interrupt and say yes. that the fish man was real sexy.
Drea Clark.
I have a real soft spot for King Kong.
And women of color.
I was like, damn!
Right, Kugel got final cut.
Kugel got final cut!
It's literally the world's saddest orgy. And believe me, I'm from San Francisco. I've been to some sad orgies.
Who Shot Ya? Listen every Friday on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Karen Tongson. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
And Tav Nyonga.
And we have another very special guest for this segment. I know, chock full of amazing specialness on this episode of Pop Rocket. But it's also a very melancholic situation we have going on because our beloved producer, the millennial of Millennial Minute, Mr. Christian Dueñas, is going to be leaving us after this episode. So, Christian, talk to us about being in the booth tonight and saying goodbye, abandoning your beloved Rocketeers.
I know, man. It's a very complicated set of feelings, you know? Like, I'm really happy that I'm, like, moving and doing some other cool shit. But at the same time, I'm like, oh, fuck. Like, yeah. You get really sad that you're going to be... Like, you get used to seeing everybody every week. And I know the reason Guy didn't come in today was because he was so... heartbroken.
Emotional. I know that.
Guy tends to not show up for people's finales.
It's true. So he didn't show up for Oliver's.
Didn't show up for Oliver's.
I knew my flight was late tonight.
I was like, my flight was going to be late. Yeah.
Not good with goodbyes. Some people aren't.
Christian, know the time has come. Anyway, my dear Christian.
I hate that that song is like the first song that people think of when they, like, that's the first Christian
that they
song.
Could think of.
I mean,
of.
That song's all right.
It's a good one. It's your motoring, sweetie.
It's all right.
Well, our dear producer, Christian, is on his way, so he's going to get to share a jam with us. But let's make our way through the rotation and let him have the finale tonight. So, Margaret Wappler, what's your jam this week?
My jam is from Ella Jenkins, who is considered the first lady of children's music. And just for those of you who are keeping score at home, this is the second jam I've played now in a row from the first lady of something. Tammy Wynette, the first lady of country last week.
Oh, well, there you go. You're really on theme.
I know. I'm on the first lady tip. So Ella was the first folk performer to teach, like, these fun, interactive songs to children in schools and preschools, and she would bring in cool little drums and teach kids about the joy of music. And basically, like, one day in front of Silas, I was just, random playing shit off of Spotify, and I played an Ella Jenkins song, and his eyes just lit up instantly.
Aww.
And the thing that's so cool is that, like, he's 6 months old. He doesn't know anything about her. Do you know what I mean? And children are just pure that way. They have no idea, but her voice just struck out like a chord, and he just grabbed on, and he knew. And now every time,
Silas.
Yeah, like, every time he's, like, kind of upset, we'll, like, play this song, and it just straightens him right out. So thank you very much, Ella Jenkins. This is her song, Who's Gonna Be Your Man?
Who's gonna glove your hand? Who's gonna kiss your red ruby lips? Who's gonna be your man? Who's gonna be your man? Oh, Lordy, me, yes, it's oh, Lordy, mine. Who's gonna be your man?
Part of the reason I wanted to play this song today is because it reminds me just a little bit of the score for Black Panther by Ludwig Göransson. It has that tambin flute in there that pops up, like, as a regular motif, and it has that ghostly, watery kind of sound. And there's just a little bit of that percussion in the background of this Ella Jenkins song that made me think of it. And I love that aspect of the score, that it has that, like, really pure... ghostly polyrhythmic quality to it.
Yeah. No, I mean, and there are so many layers to that score as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's
like you guys,
like,
said, I think it's going to be just as...
people can be talking about it.
Yeah.
Soon.
Just as monumental as the movie.
And I love that little Silas is just totally into this because I'm
he
like,
feels
always, like
it.
I'm like completely like a knee jerk, like joyous reaction to that.
I have a newborn in my life I'm going to recommend Ella Jenkins to right now.
Yes.
Amazing. Miracle of miracles, Winter Mitchell and I have the same jam again for the second week in a row. It's as if our periods are sinking, seriously.
We should probably
look at our Clue apps and see what's going on.
I'm Glow, so okay. If you want to see me cool.
And apropos that kind of ribald, seg into our song, this is the new Janelle Monáe single from her forthcoming album, Dirty Computer. And it's an incredibly sexy-feely song called Make Me Feel.
Ooh, this is a dirty computer.
Baby, don't make me spell it out for you. All of the feelings that I've got for you can't be explained, but I can try for you. Yeah, baby, don't make me spell it out for you. You keep on asking me the same questions. Why? And second guessing all my intentions.
We're going to let this play because,
you know, by the way, I use
you
my
know, it's a double jam for me in winter.
That you got the answers to my confessions. It's like I'm powerful with a little bit of tender and emotional sexual bender. Mess me up, yeah, but no one does it better. There's nothing better. That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way. She for wants the radio play, and she wants the car commercials, and she wants some elevator play, and she wants some Trader Joe's ambient play.
That's
a little like St. Vincent's
level exposure.
Yeah. Yes. But the whole thing about this song is that, you know, DJ Lenka Paris said that she first heard this song at a small party hosted by Prince. So the rumor is that Prince furnished this song, bequeathed this song. That sounds right, because it sounds like a Prince song.
Basically.
And when it gets into that chorus and it's just like that little slappy, slappy bit.
Yeah. And this sounds like Prince, like 86 Prince.
And, you know, one of the things, too, like, if you want to encounter this song for the first time, look at the music video, which she also released fairly recently, I think several days ago, with her rumored lover, Tessa Thompson. Her purported real-life boo.
What?
And, but it is like this kind of like day glow bisexual.
God,
like,
I would watch the shit out of that.
Yeah, you got to watch that. It's like kind of a day glow bisexual fantasia.
And, I'm like now transported. Skip me.
I'm saying it's like the San Junipero of like music videos. But we need to give people some sim. I know. It's a little bit like we need to like sim it down.
Yeah, we need to sim it down.
But I don't know if we're going to do that with Tav's jam. Tav, tell us what you got going on.
My jam is Michelle Ndegio Cello's amazing cover of TLC's Waterfalls with an equally amazing Gen Z video by Damani Baker. This is a track off of Michelle's forthcoming album of deep cuts of R&B covers from the 1980s and 1990s, entitled Ventriloquism. It's basically Michelle Negrocello's karaoke record, right?
Because it has
like Sometimes It Snows in April by Prince, Night and Day by Al B. Schur, Love, and Don't Disturb This Groove by The System. I mean, this is like some amazing stuff, and Private Dancer, things like that. But the song I want to play is her new cover of TLC's Waterfalls. Michelle Ndegocello has been like the kind of soundtrack of my life, and like a plug for my forthcoming paper at the EMP PopCon is about Michelle Ndegocello. I didn't know about this album until a couple weeks ago. I'm so thrilled that she's still here, like 30 years after her debut, still as vital as ever on this album, which I think may actually end up being one of her biggest ever. I don't know. This is Waterfalls.
Let's do it.
She's having some cannabis mints, you know what I mean?
legalized weed situation.
Yeah, it's beautiful, and I think that, you know, I mean, Michelle Ndegocello has, aside from being this amazing bassist and band leader and, like, force of nature, has this really amazing voice, right?
Yeah.
It really goes from a very deep bass to breathy whisper to her own weird, trans vocal version of a falsetto. And I love that she's, you know, takes a song that are songs that are very anthemic, like Waterfalls, Don't Disturb This Groove, and is doing just totally different things with them on this album.
Totally.
So 2 weeks ago, I was in a store flirting with guy at the counter, and he was talking about his upcoming trip to he's into hiking, and I was there like, oh, I'm into hiking too, right? And I just heard about this hike you can take outside LA.
Be careful saying that in LA.
Yeah, exactly.
That can mean 4 hours, or that can mean 1.5
exactly.
hours.
So I say, oh, you're into hiking. Why have I heard about this hike that has these amazing waterfalls? And without skipping a beat, he goes back, oh, I don't chase waterfalls.
Oh, damn.
I finally got that lyric after 20 years. I was like, don't chase waterfalls literally means damn. Don't chase waterfalls.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
But we also have to shout out to Homemade King, who talked specifically about this song to us.
Yes, she brought this weekend.
She brought it to our attention. It's just
Homemade,
really
the source of all pop culture lore.
It's so good. Okay. This is the saddest moment of the show tonight. We're handing it over to Christian, who you're only used to hearing guffawing in the background when we say something silly.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
But tonight
about
you
that,
get
listeners.
To hear his own. No, I think people best. Are going to really miss it. And so now you get to hear him tell us about his parting jam for Pop Rocket and Our Rocketeers.
I spent a lot of time trying to think of what jam I wanted to play. I take music semi-seriously, I guess. Like,
as you should.
I. 99% of the concerts I go to, I cry at. Like,
I love that.
It gets
that.
Me really emotional. So I was, you know, thinking, like, should I make this? Should it be a sad song? Should it be like a goodbye song? Should it be like a happy, like we're moving on song? But I think I chose this song. It's just the song I fucking love, and it's Frank Ocean's White Ferrari. One thing I have like trouble with. RE like music criticism or criticism of like things in pop culture in general is just like it's hard for me to articulate why I love something so much without like reading other like critics' opinions on it, and then like it's one of those things where like you read it and you're like, oh, I agree with this 100%, but I don't want to say it because like now I feel like I'm parroting this person's opinion on it, even though that's I don't know.
Anxiety of influence.
Yeah. It's hard to like try to make an original like critique of a song or whatever. The entire album Blonde is just fucking great. It's so good. I listen to it like all the time, and maybe like half the time I cry during it.
You heard it here, folks. Christian cries all the time.
I cry a lot at
But
music.
Like what makes you cry? Like what is it
I
about
think it's
it?
Just like the raw like just the emotion of
expressiveness.
It, you know, like just it's just like, oh, I wish I can like be this expressive, you know, like I wish I can like tell people like how I actually feel about shit. And there's this so at the end of the song White Ferrari, there's this like little spoken word part that I sometimes just listen to this part by itself. It's so great.
I'm sure we're taller in another dimension. You say we're small and not worth the mention. You're tired of moving, your body's aching. We could vacate, there's places to go. Clearly this is it. All that there is can't take what's been given. But we're so okay here, we're doing fine. Primal and naked, you dream of walls that hold us in prison. It's just a skull lease, that's what they call it, and we're free to
walk. I fucking love this song. And it's weird saying that because it's like a year and a half old, but it's legit one of my like favorite songs I've ever heard in my life.
It's beautiful.
This man speaks to me. yeah, I just wanted to share that song just because this is the last thing.
Well, Chris, you know, your words, I fucking love this or I fucking love this song, are completely apt for how you've been able to manage our voices throughout your run here as a producer on Pop Rocket. And you let us speak, you let us talk about what we love, and you find a way to bring it all together in the most beautiful form for others to hear. And we're so grateful for everything that you do for us, from like letting us in. We're like, let us into the garage. We can't get into the building. To the beautiful bottle of boxed Vendage you brought for us to drink tonight in studio.
Only the best.
Vendage.
Only the best for 7-Eleven.
And so with that, we bid good night, my friends. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Karen Tongson, with Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and our special guest, Tavya Nyong'o. Tavya, where can our listeners find you if they want to hear more?
Shadow Study on Twitter.
At Shadow Study on Twitter. And, nice. You know, you've also, you can follow our producer and see what he's up to in his next universe at Butts on a Butt, one of my favorite Twitter handles ever.
It's pretty great.
And that's like two T's in the butts. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. A lot of butts.
A lot of butts with two T's. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Isaac Kapow and A. Hillary, not B or C. Hillary, for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. Isaac Kapow says the show is, quote, very thought-provoking, yet still funny at the same time. So thank you, Isaac, for finding our provocations humorous. So if you want to be part of the conversation, get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and be part of the discussion. We're a production of MaximumFun.org. And our producer, ending his storied run here on Pop Rocket, is the most adorable and the most loving Christian Twink.
Love you guys.
Love you too, Christian. Gonna miss you.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.